Welcome back to the annual podcast episode of Rebecca's Podcasts. On this podcast, I discuss a new historical topic each year. In my last episode, I discussed Jewish women in Catalonia. This year, I'm discussing LGBTQ history, just in time for Pride Month, this June. I'm specifically focusing on lesbian history in the medieval period, including sodomy cases between women and how their sexuality is perceived in the court system. Although, I will also be discussing LGBTQ history as a whole, including transgender history and outlining the importance of discussing minority identities and perceptions of gender in history. It is an important disclaimer that this history is based on access and availability to sources. Women's sodomy cases are seldomly seen in the court records, therefore creating a silence in history and in the academic discussion. Therefore, this podcast is an overview of lesbian and transgender history throughout Europe in the medieval period. This research is possible because of academics in the field already having these important discussions. Helmut Puff's article, Female Sodomy, The Trial of Katharina Hetzeldorfer, includes an appendix of her translation of the Hetzeldorfer trial, making research more accessible. Puff gives an excellent overview of the trial, the context, and the importance of recognizing female sodomy. Puff is attempting to use the trial to unsettle the myth of lesbian impunity, which I will discuss later on, invisibility or insignificance, and shift our attention to the various sites where, despite the politics of silence, female sodomy became legible in a multitude of ways. Helmut Puff's article also brings up important components of studying LGBTQ history. She advocates for recognizing the silence in the discourse and the archives. Despite the research that has been done, there are still gaps in the scholarship and more work is to be done on LGBTQ history, specifically medieval history. Puff also mentions issues of misinterpretation of evidence. The article mentions scholar Theodore Harster, who had read the Hetzeldorfer trial and argued Hetzeldorfer as a prostitute. Others following his work did not return to the source to confirm his argument. This misinterpretation therefore obscured the history and limited the recognition of LGBTQ identities in the past. There is an emphasis on returning to the sources and reading between the lines, recognizing what is and is not there in the archives and the sources. Lesbian impunity, which is an important argument within the discussion, is the notion that same-sex relations among women went unnoticed and unpunished. This later translates into that women's same-sex relationships did not exist, and many scholars are attempting to disrepute this myth. Edith Benkov's The Erase Lesbian Sodomy and the Legal Tradition in Medieval Europe attempts a similar argument. Benkov suggests a more fruitful approach would be an exploration of the dialects of texts that locate female homoerotic relations in the domain of sinful or criminal sexual practices and considering lesbian identity in the medieval Europe. Benkov lays out the legal and theological discussion that leads to the prosecution of women's same-sex relationships. Her article gives an excellent outline of the discourse and some of the key themes within female sodomy. An important piece of work for understanding lesbian history, and especially the discourse and scholarship around lesbian history, is The L Word in Women's History, a chapter in Judith Bennett's History Matters, Patriarchy and the Challenge of Feminism. Bennett outlines the gaps that are regarding lesbian and LGBTQ history because of the active willingness to disbelieve lesbian history, quoting Judith Brown, another prominent scholar. Much of women's history skips lightly over the presence of lesbians and the possibility of lesbian experience. Bennett attributes this to the fact that many people still see the past in hetero terms, and from Bennett's words, a lack of gaydar pervades all fields in women's history. Bennett does give a suggestion, though, through the term lesbian-like. This term is then able to broaden the history to include lesbian-like experiences, including lives that men have offered opportunities for same-sex love, women who resisted norms of feminine behavior based on heterosexual marriage, and women who lived in circumstances that allowed them to nurture and support other women. Some examples would include women who chose singleness and live outside of the gender expectations, including cross-dressing. This term and discussion is important because it opens up some more avenues for historians to recognize LGBTQ history and same-sex love without attempting to determine one's identity in the past using modern terminology. These historians that I've discussed are incredibly important in the discussion of LGBTQ, specifically lesbian history. Although a major problem is that most of these sources were written between about 1990 and 2003. The primary sources would need to be re-examined and rediscussed with a refreshed perspective. This is a main reason why it is important to discuss LGBTQ history. Yet there are also many more reasons. As described by Sahar Amer, female same-sex desire and practices, if not a specific identity, then at least an actual consciousness, existed in the West well before the 19th century. This can be applied to many LGBTQ identities. Women's same-sex love, lesbian-like, and transgender identities have always been around, and that's an important component to the activism. Ideas of newness, of transgender and other LGBTQ experiences have been used to undermine the legitimacy of non-binary genders, trans people, activists, and scholars. They have had to fight to claim the historicity of trans lives through the evidence we have, which I will be discussing some more later in the episode as well. The myth of lesbian impunity and the treatment of female sodomy has caused significant problems. Female sodomy was the unnameable crime, being treated as completely horrible and against nature. When discussed in theology and legal texts, it is not given a name. Crimes that cannot be named thus had no name and left few traces in the historical record. Western society built an impenetrable barrier that has lasted throughout history and has made it impossible to discuss lesbian sexuality openly, if at all. This is another specific reason why it's important to discuss lesbian history specifically, as it opens the door for better understanding of sexuality and personal identities, and tearing down the barrier that has been up for so long. Alongside these many social benefits for the LGBTQ community and everyone involved, and the representation in history, studying sodomy cases can tell us a lot about medieval history in general. When reading legal documents, specifically female sodomy cases, historians can have an understanding of many different perspectives. Most obviously, we see the perspective of the scribe. A scribe is someone transcribing or writing down what is being said and happening in a trial. It is important to note that they often summarize the witness and accused's testimonies. Because of this, when we read the sources, we can see the aspects that may have been more important to the scribe or read between the lines for what have been left out. Also, in a trial that I'll be discussing later, the Hetzeldorfer trial, the scribe wrote in the margins and underlined sections, showing their confusion and surprise for what had been said. These trials also show a male and a lead perspectives of women who engaged in sex with other women. A major component of these trials and sources is ideas about gender roles and expectations. A theme in the trials is a focus on deviancy involving gender, and less emphasis is placed on the sexual acts that they were being prosecuted for. An example is women living outside of their expected gender identities, or acting in a masculine way. This is really heavily emphasized in the trials that I'll be discussing later. I also want to emphasize that in order to fully understand LGBTQ history, we need to reach beyond the individual stories and recognize the structures that embody them and even how they reach into the modern perceptions. So while I am using some examples to explain the history later in this episode, it is important to remember that they are within the structures that define them and give them their context. In order for you, the listeners, to have a better understanding of the trials that I'm going to be discussing, I'm going to give you some definitions to help you understand some key terms. And so some of these definitions may be debated within the communities, but I'm going to give you what I'm using for the context of this podcast. So with the term lesbian, from what I have seen within society, a modern definition is non-men loving non-men. This is in place of a previous definition of women loving women exclusively, as it opens up the space and identifier for non-binary or gender fluid people. And lesbian-like, as discussed earlier, expands the possibilities in women's lives in ways that other affinities with modern lesbians, with female words of love and ritual. Lesbian can also be seen either as a noun or an adjective. The noun would describe one's identity, a single person, identifying as a lesbian, while the adjective may describe the relationship between two women or their actions, which I think is similar to the lesbian-like. And for transgender experience, I'm using a definition from M.W. Bychowski, because I think it really best describes the transgender experience. And they state that, meaning that of someone whose gender challenges social assignments and categories. Because of this definition, I see a lot of overlap regarding lesbian-like and transgender identities. Women who transcend and deviate female gender roles could be described as either lesbian-like or transgender, although it may take into consideration the extra context. It is also important to note that these definitions are not hard and fast boundaries and may overlap or change depending on the context and time. And this is especially true for LGBTQ identities today. Somebody who may identify as a lesbian at one point in their life may change over time, especially with further realization of who they are. And so in regards to the sodomy trials, for sodomy was kind of heavily debated throughout the history and different definitions were given. But in the medieval period, it could be typically described as carnal intercourse in the wrong vessel, which excludes women having sex with other women, but it is also broad enough to include heterosexual couples, as it can typically be described as sex for a non-procreative reason. But it is also important to recognize that the first definition based on within the inappropriate vessel does not include women, and a lot of sodomy cases or a lot of theological discussion was based on a phallic understanding of sexuality and didn't necessarily include women, but heavily focused on the phallic object. Before I dive into the examples of sodomy trials, it's important to understand the historical context. Although I do have a disclaimer that because of the availability of sources, I'm analyzing three trials from different periods and places. So I can't, and historians can't, make sweeping generalizations about that because of the difference in space and in social context. Although we can recognize some themes and patterns that occur because they were within a larger structure, specifically that of the patriarchy and the development of homophobia. Much of the discussion around female sodomy was in theological writings and penitential literature written by the Catholic Church. Penitential literature were designed as guidebooks for confessors and dealt with a range of behaviors that were contrary to Christian teachings. One of the most significant of these writings is Hincmar of Reims, who noted that women do not put flesh to flesh, but instead use instruments of diabolical operations, or a dildo. This is another example of phallic-centered ideas of sexuality. In the Summa Theologiae by Thomas Aquinas, it subsumed four categories of vice against nature under lust, including masturbation, bestiality, coitus in an unnatural position, and copulation with an undue sex, which is male and male or female and female. An awareness of lesbian acts also brought efforts to curb it in monastic communities. St. Augustine warned his sister who took holy vows, although without making any specifics to give her any ideas. While the Catholic Church influenced many laws and confessionals, the secular authorities, city governments, and territorial rulers were the main agents attempting to eliminate sodomy. So the law was a little bit tricky in the medieval period, having many different distinctions and law codes, even over different or overlapping areas. It is also important because it shapes the cases we are looking at today, as they are all legal trials in the courts. LGBTQ people throughout history have often lived outside the social and legal norms, and their fates have often been shaped by and defined by the legal system. The main distinctions in law include Roman law, which influenced Europe beginning in about the 12th century and is based on ancient Roman law. Customary law is based on customs in use and was verbal before being compiled and written down, mostly being understood within communities. And canon law, which comes from the power of the Catholic Church and is based on scripture and writings from the church fathers. They mostly had jurisdiction over religious crimes. Although sodomy was a little bit tricky and went between secular and religious courts depending on what area it was. England, which is where one of my case studies come from, have a different system, which is called common law, which is based on custom and precedent set from previous rulings by a judge. For the first case that I'm going to be discussing, which is the trial of Katharina Hetzeldorfer, it's important to understand the individual context of Germany that defines the case. The trial occurred in about 1477 Speyer, Germany. This case occurred in Germany prior to the German Protestant Reformation and before the reception of Roman law. After the Reformation, there was extended training of government officials and the professionalization among lawyers, legal advisors, and civil servants. Developments that had a profound impact on the wording of court documents, which had not occurred yet. Speyer also did not have any law which mentioned sexual acts between women or men. Therefore, customary law may have filled the void in this case. Katharina Hetzeldorfer left Nuremberg, Germany, 2 years prior to the court proceedings in Speyer. There is a middle-class family of the same name that is well-documented as proof of Hetzeldorfer originally being from Nuremberg. Hetzeldorfer migrated with a woman and presented the woman as their sister. Hetzeldorfer then lived with this woman in Speyer for 2 years, and there was likely rumors and whispers about the two of them leading to the court case. Much of the work on this case comes from Helmut Pfaff, who also included a translation of the case in the appendix of her article, which I am very grateful for. One of the witnesses slash accused is a woman named Elsie, the wife of Wendell Muter, who states the accused came to her house when her husband was not at home, then seduced Elsie and tried to, quote, have her manly will with her. Elsie stated that Hetzeldorfer had a penis and she could hardly ward her off. Elsie then emphasizes that she believed Hetzeldorfer to be a man, as they behaved exactly like a man with women. In the court case, there's a description of the dildo that Hetzeldorfer used, which was made out of a piece of leather, a red leather that at the front was filled with cotton and a wooden stick stuck into it. The courts were heavily interested in how the sex was conducted, therefore the description of the dildo. This also calls back to the emphasis on the phallic discussion of sexuality, as the courts were really emphasizing, like, how are they conducting sex, and we need to know the specifics of it. The accused, Hetzeldorfer, had also constructed themselves as the husband in the 2-year relationship with the woman that they came to Speyer with. Hetzeldorfer was eventually drowned, a punishment given for women and is incredibly shameful. While the woman Hetzeldorfer had sex with were kicked out of town 10 miles, which was Elsie Muter. This case highlights some of the key themes about female sodomy in medieval Europe. A main component were the concerns heavily focused on Hetzeldorfer's gender more than the actual sex that she was being charged with. The judges were heavily occupied with the dividing line between sexes, both physiologically and behaviorally, which is seen with the emphasis on how two women had sex, the use of the dildo, and on Hetzeldorfer's masculine features and behavior. The emphasis on gender is also highlighted by the fact that Hetzeldorfer, taking on a masculine role, was more heavily prosecuted than the other women. Hetzeldorfer was executed, and Elsie Muter was only banished from the town. Hetzeldorfer, I would argue, is also an example of the boundaries of lesbian-like and transgender history overlapping. Hetzeldorfer is in a female and female relationship, therefore being descriptively a lesbian relationship or acting lesbian-like in their behavior. Hetzeldorfer's manly behavior could be considered lesbian-like because of the manly behavior to pursue a relationship with other women. Although, this manly behavior can also be interpreted as Hetzeldorfer being a trans man, taking on a manly identity in the relationship and the community, and wanting to be perceived as a man. Another prominent case is of Bertolina from 1295 Bologna, northern Italy. Bertolina is nicknamed Gorsia, and I will be referring to her as Gorsia from now on. She is accused in the civic court of sodomy with other women. This case is also significant because it shows a man using a charge of sodomy in the court to attack a woman. So the case began with an anonymous court notification, and the judge is required to respond by holding an inquest. 4 men were then questioned from the community, and they knew nothing of her reputation. so the accuser stepped forward to pursue the case and provide witnesses. Guglielmo, the accuser, had three noblemen and two witnesses who were guaranteed by the noblemen. The guarantee ensures the court sees the validity of the witness testimonies. The most important witness in the case is Ugolino. And an interesting component of this is that the notary recorded his testimony in first person, showing a sense of immediacy instead of summarizing it as discussed earlier. Ugolino's testimony provides a story where he attempts to hire some men to play music and pursue a widow from the community. During this, he meets Garcia, who had originally hired the men, and she, in a conversation with Ugolino, admits to being interested in the widow for 2 years. Ugolino responds that she is mala fortunata, which is unlucky because she likes women, and he sees no way that she can act upon her desires as a woman. This highlights the societal idea about a phallocentric understanding of sexuality as well. Then Garcia describes to Ugolino that she has a silk virilia, being male organs. She had no hesitation of showing the virilia and little fear of being persecuted. Just a side note, the virilia would have been used as a dildo, as similar in the Hetzeldorfer case. Prior to the court trial, people had gossiped about Garcia, but saw no evidence of serious concern. Her behavior may have been unusual to the community, but it was in no way disrupting society. And within this case, there's also a stark contrast between the initial notification, which she shows Garcia as sexually deviant and outside of the law, and even attributes her to other crimes, including witchcraft and prostitution. But Ugolino's testimony shows romance and love. Garcia hired singers and had their allegiance in order to romance a woman she was interested in, finding a way to act on her attraction with the silk virilia. This case gives us an indirect glimpse into the stories of women who loved other women. This is important for us to understand and recognize as representation of women loving women throughout history. For my final case study, I'm going to be talking about Eleanor Reichner, which is a case of a trans woman in 1394 London, England. Eleanor was arrested for having sex in the streets with a man, and the authorities had later realized that Eleanor was born a male. The trial focuses on the crime as sodomy, and Eleanor, who had continually referred to herself as Eleanor in the court documents, explains the sex work she was involved in. She had learned how to dress as a woman and act as a prostitute from other women, likely her friends or colleagues. She had received money for sex with John Brittany, which is the person she was caught with originally. Eleanor had admitted to sex with many women as a man as well. Although Eleanor acted as a woman and used the name Eleanor for many years. Eleanor is a prominent example of transgender identity in medieval Europe. We could even go as to say an example of non-binary or gender fluid identity is because of the fluidity in her identity. Although acting as a woman and using the name Eleanor, she still took on the role of a man and had sex with other women, showing like the variety of her identity. This case like heavily helps to debunk the idea that trans identities are new and therefore threatening. Trans people have been around for centuries and we have multiple examples. Eleanor is only one of them. And transgender identities is a new idea. Another main issue within the court case is Eleanor being described as deceiving and tricking because these men that she was having sex with didn't know that she was originally a male. And I wanted to note this because this is a really common issue with trans women when they are dating within their lives and being young and having dates with people and wanting to have a romantic life. They are put in extreme danger because men think that they're being deceived by their identity, and therefore a lot of trans women have been murdered because of that. So it's really important to recognize the long history in order to help explain that to people and to recognize that trans women are women and their original sex doesn't determine that. So thank you for listening today. I hope this episode helps you further understand the significance and importance of studying LGBTQ people in history and potentially the danger that they've been in and the discrimination that they've experienced throughout history as well. So if you want to do some more and do your own research, I do have an extra reading list that I would recommend. So Transhistorical Gender Plurality Before the Modern is a collection of essays regarding studying trans history, and it's edited by Greta Lapierre, Masha Raskolnikov, and Anna Kudoskoska. It heavily discusses like trans identities and recognizing that in history and how to approach it. Sodomy and Reformation Germany and Switzerland, 1400 to 1600 by Helmut Puff, gives a really good broad and also specific ideas of sodomy and Reformation Germany and Switzerland, and it includes more information about Katharina Hetzeldorfer and that trial, and also broader ideas of sodomy, including male homosexuality. Crossing Borders, Love Between Women in Medieval French and Arabic Literatures by Sahar Emmer. This scholar gives some more specific information and shows the literature and evidence of different identities and women's same-sex love. And The Shape of Sex, Non-Binary Gender from Genesis to the Renaissance by Leah D. Thanks again for listening, and I hope to give you some more history in a year from now. So thanks and bye.